Welcome and thank you for standing by. I would like to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you very much. So welcome to the May 2009 Charm Telecon. Our speaker today is Adam Masters. He's from Imperial College in London in the UK. And he's finishing up his PhD under the guidance of the magnetometer PI, Michelle Dougherty, on the Cassini spacecraft. So for his research leading to his PhD, he's done some interesting work looking at Saturn's magnetosphere, magnetospheric boundaries, the magnetopause and bow shock, and some of the processes that occur at those boundaries and lead us to a better understanding of how energy and momentum from the solar wind get coupled to the magnetosphere. And that's what he's going to talk about today. And he's prepared some really nice graphics. I know oftentimes the magnetosphere is a little bit obtuse for people to understand, but I think it looks like he'll be able to do a really good job with a lot of really descriptive figures. So with that, the title of his talk is The Effects of the Solar Wind on Saturn's Space Environment. And with that, welcome, Adam.
Thank you very much, Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the introduction.
Sure.
Hello, everyone. Just to reiterate, I'm Adam Masters, and I'm based at Imperial College London at the moment. It's been very sunny here, which is never really the case if there are visitors from the States. So I think this telecon just having a link with the US has led to sunny weather, I'm not sure. So the title of what I'm going to be talking about today is, as Marcia said, The Effects of the Solar Wind on Saturn's Space Environment. So before I begin, I just want to say that I'm going to basically give a review of our understanding of the environment around the planet and the planet's outer magnetosphere. And I'm going to be showing figures and results that numerous members of the Cassini science community have contributed to, and a small part of that is my own work. So I'd like to begin by thanking everyone and just making it clear that this is sort of our current understanding of this region of the environment. Okay, so if we go to slide 2, this is an outline of what I'm going to be talking about. So the focus is going to be the physics of Saturn's magnetosphere. I'm aware that a lot of previous Charm telecons have been regarding the spacecraft hardware and, you know, ice satellite observations and things like that. So what I'm going to do today is focus on the physics, like I said. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is solar wind, which emanates from the sun, and I'm going to talk about space plasmas and what's special about them. I'm then going to talk about the Saturn system, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and what happens when the solar wind interacts with the planet and the planet's magnetic field. I'll then say a little bit about Cassini's exploration of the magnetosphere, and with the prime mission and the current Cassini Equinox mission, we're getting very good coverage of the system, which we can use to learn quite a lot. I'm then going to talk about why we're interested in studying solar wind and how it can affect the magnetosphere. So I'm going to focus on four particular ways in which the solar wind can affect the environment around the planet, the first being the size of the magnetosphere itself, the auroral emissions we see emanating from the high latitude upper atmosphere, reconnection, which is the process I'll have to introduce in some detail, and finally waves in the outer magnetosphere. And finally I'll summarize what we currently understand regarding the interaction between the solar wind and the planet. At the end of each of these sections I'm going to pause and ask if anyone has any questions, so at that stage please feel free to ask anything that's on your mind. Okay, so if we now go to slide number 3, so to begin with, what's the solar wind? Well, as many of you are probably aware, the sun is basically composed of charged particles, partially ionized gas. So these are particles that are not bound together as atoms or molecules, and we call this partially ionized gas a plasma. Now, there are lots of examples of plasmas that you can find on the surface of the Earth, and one thing that they all have in common is that they respond, they really respond to electric and magnetic fields. So, to describe what the solar wind is, if you imagine that at the solar surface there is certain gas pressure, and at the edge of the outer solar system, or past the orbits of all the planets, there's a region where the pressure is far lower. So if we look at the schematic on the bottom right of this slide, this is a very crude illustration of what I'm trying to say. So in the center of the schematic, you've got the sun, which is obviously a ball of gas. And then right at the outer edge of the solar system, shaded as a grey region, is the low pressure out of the solar system relative to the solar surface. So as a result of this big pressure difference between the surface of the Sun, so the corona, for example, and the low pressure out of the solar system, as a result of that, you actually get a flow of solar material away from the Sun. So this, you can imagine this as the Sun's atmosphere extending out into interplanetary space. And that's illustrated in the schematic. So the solar wind is the flow of the Sun's atmosphere away from the Sun radially into the outer solar system because of the large pressure difference. Okay, so this image on the top right is quite a beautiful image. I remember when I first saw it, I was amazed. It's an amalgamation of different images taken during a solar eclipse. And the reason I put it in is that you can clearly see the solar wind flowing away from the Sun. So you can see that around when the visible surface is covered, you can see all this structure. And this is really an important phenomenon because all of the planets in the solar system are immersed in its flow. And it's got some important implications for the interaction with the planets and the Sun. Okay, so if we go to the fourth slide, so what is special about space plasmas? Well, interplanetary space is not empty. As we've just seen, it's filled with this solar wind flow, so it's a flow of charged particles away from the Sun. And this is very, very low density. In fact, it's a better vacuum than vacuums we can make in a laboratory on the surface of the Earth. And because of these very low densities, there's an important consequence which we call frozen influx. So if we look at the schematic on the right-hand side of this slide, once again, this is a really simple illustration of two different space plasmas. So I've called them Space Plasma 1, which is shaded in red, and Space Plasma 2, which is shaded in blue. Now, the magnetic field can be described as field lines, as I'm sure many of you are aware. So in each case, there are a certain set of magnetic field lines that thread each path of plasma, which you can see. Now, as a consequence of the very low density of space plasmas like the solar wind, what happens is that the plasma and the magnetic field become frozen together, so we refer to them as being frozen in. Essentially what that means is that wherever the plasma goes, the magnetic field lines have to go as well. So if a path of the plasma with associated field lines threading it is to move from A to B, the field lines also have to move. In some cases the magnetic field will be in control of the dynamics. In other cases, the plasma is in control of the dynamics. But frozen influx is generally a very good approximation in the sort of highly tenuous space plasmas we're dealing with. For example, the solar wind, and also the plasma in the space environment around Saturn. So the final thing to say is that as a result of this frozen influx approximation, two different space plasmas, so highly tenuous, very low density plasmas, which are both frozen into the magnetic field, cannot mix. And this has important consequences we're going to see in the next few slides. So, moving on to slide number 5. So the solar wind, as I've already said, flows radially away from the Sun because of the pressure difference. Now, the Sun itself generates a magnetic field in the same way that a permanently magnetic material would, for example, like a bar magnet, for example. So what we can now ask is, given that the solar wind is flowing away from the Sun, and that magnetic field lines of solar origin are frozen into the flow, what does this do? What does this imply regarding the structure of the magnetic field in interplanetary space? So if we look at the schematic on the left-hand side, this is a picture, once again, the Sun's in the center, and we're looking down approximately on the north pole of the Sun, let's say. So you can imagine the Sun as a bar magnet where the north pole is coming out of the page towards you. Now this block grey arrow illustrates the rotation of the Sun, and the black arrows give the radial flow of the solar wind away from the solar surface. So what's going to happen is, because of frozen influx, the solar magnetic field gets pulled out into interplanetary space by the solar wind flow, because the field lines are tied to the plasma, plasma's flowing away from the Sun, and so the field's also got to extend out into the region between the planets. And we call this extension of the solar magnetic field the interplanetary magnetic field. And you'll often hear people use the abbreviation IMF to describe that field that pervades interplanetary space. But a final thing I'd like to say about this is that, as you can see from the schematic, because of the rotation of the Sun, if you imagine that a field line is frozen into a part of the plasma, plasma flowing radially away from the sun, coupled with the rotation of the sun, is going to produce this famous Parker spiral orientation of the IMF. So you can think of it as the part of the plasma moves away, the field line is pulled with it because of the rotation, you're twisting up the field. And I think that's clear from the schematic, but the point I'm trying to get across from this is that interplanetary space it consists of a solar wind flow, which is very fast and it's moving away from the sun, and it's got an associated magnetic field, which we call the interplanetary magnetic field, or IMF. Okay, at this stage, does anybody have any questions? Okay, so moving on to slide number 6, I'm now going to say a little bit about Saturn and its magnetosphere. Now, I'm aware a number of telecons have concerned various aspects of the system, for example, Saturn's moon. So this really nice illustration here shows the Saturn system, so showing the relative sizes of the planetary satellites in the upper panel, for example, Titan, Enceladus, Rhea, Dione, Iapetus. And the bottom panel shows where the moons are situated relative to planets. So I'm not going to dwell too much on this. I mean, I'm sure you're all aware that Saturn's atmosphere is mainly composed of hydrogen and helium. There's numerous satellites. And as Cassini has shown, some of these satellites, particularly it appears in Enceladus, very important for the dynamics of the region around the planet as it is ejecting water ice from one of its poles. Okay, so this is just sort of an overview of the Saturn system. So if we move on to slide number 7, this slide concerns Saturn's magnetic field. So a good way of thinking about a planetary magnetic field is that it's very similar to a bar magnet in some respects. So in the top right of this schematic is something which I'm sure everyone's very familiar with. If you place iron filings in the vicinity of a bar magnet, the iron filings are going to trace out the magnetic field lines like we've been talking about. And so obviously a compass can tell you, can also trace the field line structure as shown in that particular schematic. So, Saturn, like the Earth, has an intrinsic magnetic field. So it has a magnetic north pole, magnetic south pole. And what we call this sort of field structure, which is very similar to the Earth, is we say it's dipolar. So we call the axis of the magnetic field the magnetic dipole axis. And the processes that cause this field is a whole other topic that I'm no expert in, but it's called planetary dynamo theory, and it's related to internal process. So for the moment, suffice to say that Saturn has a magnetic field which you can describe as a bar magnet dipolar field. Okay, so in the schematic, we're looking at Saturn, and you can see that the red line is the planet's magnetic dipole axis, with the north pole at the top, the south pole at the south, so the bottom of the schematic. These black arrowed lines give the magnetic field lines, and you can see the rings indicated as well. One very peculiar feature of planet Saturn is that Saturn's rotation axis, so the rotation about which the planet spins, and the magnetic dipole axis are very closely aligned to less than 1 degree. And that's illustrated by the black grey arrow near the North Pole, which shows the spin of the planet. I'm not going to focus on this, but certainly a peculiar feature of the planet which people still don't understand. Okay, so if we move on to slide 8, we can now pose the question. So we've looked at the solar wind, and we've seen that highly tenuous space plasmas, there's a frozen influx approximation where the plasma and field are frozen together and have to move together. So what happens when the solar wind flow that immerses all the planets encounters Saturn with its own magnetic field and really complicated planetary environment where there's lots of moons contributing plasma and neutrals to the environment around the planet? Well, okay, so going back to the frozen influx approximation and what we were talking about there, we had two regimes. So in this case, we've also got two plasma regimes. So in this schematic, it's a very simple representation of the interaction. So if you imagine the solar wind flow is incident from the left-hand side, given by these black grey arrows. So they're labelled solar wind flow. So that's one plasma regime, solar wind plasma with associated IMF field lines. And obviously around the planet, you have the planet's magnetic field and plasma, for example, origin, the icy satellites or the rings or planetary ionosphere. So there are your two plasma and field regimes, and as we've seen, in this sort of highly tenuous medium, the two cannot mix. So as a result, Saturn's magnetic field becomes confined to a cavity around the planet that we call the planet's magnetosphere. So this is essentially the origin of the magnetospheric cavity and why it's there, because Saturn's got a sufficiently strong magnetic field to basically be an obstacle to the solar wind flow. So in this diagram, the magnetosphere is in effect a really complicated three-dimensional cavity around the planet, and there's many, many more layers of complication we could add to this, but for the moment I'm just showing a cross-section of the magnetosphere to illustrate the boundaries. Okay, so if we move on to slide number 9, in the next few slides I'm going to go through the outer regions of this this system, because obviously this talk is going to focus on how the solar wind can affect the magnetospheric system. So the magnetospheric system is where we find most of Saturn's satellites, and so we're going to focus on these outer regions where there's a direct interaction between the solar wind and the planet's magnetic field and its magnetosphere. So on slide number 9, the solar wind approaches the planet and it flows at a speed of approximately 500 kilometers per second. It can range over quite a large extent. It can be as high as 1,000 kilometers per second, as low as 200. But whichever way you look at it, it flows very, very fast. So this is one way of thinking about this. It's analogous to an aircraft that's traveling above the speed of sound. So if you imagine a jet aircraft in the neutral atmosphere of the Earth, moving at a supersonic speed, you get a shock wave in front of the aircraft. Now, the case of Saturn's magnetosphere, which is an obstacle to the solar wind flow, is very similar. And essentially, to slow down the flow so it can flow around the obstacle, there needs to be a shock wave, which we call the bow shock. And that's illustrated by this solid blue line in the schematic. So, once again, solar wind, as we know, is incident from the left, and at the bow shock, it slows down. Okay, so if we go to slide number 10, we're now looking at the region immediately downstream of the bow shock. So as the solar wind crosses the bow shock, it's heated, it's compressed, and it's slowed down. And this allows it to then flow around the obstacle of the planet's magnetosphere. So we call this region the magnetosheath, and it's characterized by a lot of turbulence. Okay, in slide number 11, we're now looking at the magnetopause boundary. So this is essentially the boundary of the magnetospheric cavity. So inside the magnetopause, you're in, planetward of the magnetopause, you're in Saturn's magnetosphere, whereas anti-planetward of the magnetopause, you're still in the solar wind, you're in the sheath region. So this is really the boundary of the magnetospheric cavity itself. And generally, solar wind plasma and plasma of Saturn system origin cannot cross this surface. So to the first approximation, this is a closed boundary which separates one plasma regime, the solar wind, from the other plasma regime, which is the planet's plasma and field. Another important aspect of the magnetopause, other than being a sort of boundary between the two environments, is also that its position is determined to a large extent by pressure balance. So it's a balance between the external pressure of the solar wind, which is mostly dynamic pressure, so it's the pressure of the flow hitting the obstacle. It's balanced against the internal pressure, so this is the planet's field, which resists being compressed. So this has important repercussions, because changes in the external pressure of the solar wind are going to change the position of pressure balance, so the magnetopause would have to move, and as we'll see later, that is important for how the solar wind can affect the system. Okay, in slide number 12, this is just to say that within the magnetopause, in the region that's inside the red line which represents the magnetopause, you're in Saturn's magnetosphere. So on the sunward side of the planet, which is labelled here, Saturn's magnetic field is compressed. So it's a dipolar field, but it's compressed because it's got to stay within the magnetospheric cavity. And finally, to finish this sequence of schematics, in slide number 13, on the anti-sunward side of the planet, the field lines extend to produce a long magneto tail, and that's illustrated and labelled in the schematic here. And this tail extends a long way behind the planet. To give an idea of how long planetary magneto tails can extend, for the case of Jupiter, for one of the Voyager flybys of Saturn in the early 80s, we believe that Jupiter's magnetic tail actually was aligned with Saturn. So Saturn's whole magnetosphere was immersed in Jupiter's magnetic tail, which was, you know, halfway between Saturn and the Sun almost. So that gives you an idea of how long a planetary magnetic tail can extend. And Jupiter has a magnetosphere of a similar anatomy to Saturn. So this is a very large system, and it's extended on the anti-sunward side and compressed on the sunward side. So at this stage, are there any more questions regarding what I've said so far?
Yeah, can we assume that this picture is closely analogous to Earth's magnetic field?
Yeah, to a large extent. For the case of the Earth, you'd have to flip the dipole around. So the magnetic north pole would now become the magnetic in the direction of the south pole. But otherwise, the anatomy of the magnetosphere at Earth is very similar to the anatomy of the magnetosphere at Saturn and Jupiter. There are a lot of distinct differences in terms of scale, rotation rate of the planet, and dynamics. But essentially, the anatomy is the same. You have a magnetopause, magnetic sheath, a bow shock. Is that okay? Do you have any other questions regarding that?
Oh, thanks.
Okay. Great. So, moving on to slide number 14. So now we've that's basically the introduction to Saturn's magnetosphere, why it forms, and how the solar wind flows around the cavity and the outer boundary. So, okay, on slide number 14, we can talk about our motivation. So, why should we study the interaction between the solar wind and the planet's magnetosphere? So, this region around the planet is its space environment, its magnetosphere. Okay, so as we're going to see in the following slides, and as I alluded to in the outline, solar wind can have some really profound effects on Saturn's magnetospheric system. So this is the environment that most of the moons find themselves in, for example. So since it can really affect the magnetospheric system, it's important that we understand how the solar wind and magnetosphere are coupled. As we've just seen, the question was very well-timed, actually. Many other planets have magnetospheres, for example, the Earth and Jupiter, which we can make a lot of comparisons with. And we've seen that in many respects Saturn's interaction between its magnetosphere and the solar wind is very different. And this can reveal some really important aspects of the physics that's going on and can really tell us something about, for example, how the Earth's magnetosphere responds to changes in the solar wind. So I think this is sufficient motivation to really try and understand the interaction. Okay, so if we move to slide number 15. I'm sure you've heard many talks which talk about the spacecraft and its orbital course, so I'm going to just have two slides now just mentioning Cassini's approach and orbital tour of Saturn and the sort of measurements we can make. So on this first slide, slide number 15, first of all, I'd like to apologise for the horrific typo in the title. It's completely my fault, so if you delete the, it will make sense. So during Cassini's approach to the planet, as you're all aware, Cassini was launched in October 1997. Numerous planetary swing bys on its interplanetary trajectory to Saturn. It swung by Jupiter in December to the year 2000, and then spent approximately 4.5 years, on its way to Saturn to arrive on the 1st of July 2004. And during this period of time, during specific intervals, the Hubble Space Telescope also took images of the planet, which allows to further study how the solar wind can affect the magnetosphere. Because since Cassini was upstream of the obstacle, we could measure the solar wind, and we could see what sort of solar wind structure there was. And using the HST images, we could see how the magnetosphere and the planet's auroral emissions responded to that. Okay, so that's Cassini's approach to Saturn, and we were able to see the solar wind. So if we now go to slide number 16, this slide concerns Cassini's exploration of the magnetosphere. Okay, so the figure on the left-hand side is quite cluttered, but essentially it's Cassini's orbital tour of Saturn. So in red is, well, first of all, the cross-section we're looking at is a cross-section of the magnetosphere in the planet's equatorial plane. So we're looking down on the planet's north pole. The planet is very difficult to see. I didn't even bother trying to put it in here because there's so many, the trajectory takes up so much space. But essentially it's at the middle of all these petals. So if we're looking down on the planet's north pole, the solid black lines give the intersection of the magnetopause and bow shock surfaces with this with the equatorial plane, so you can see their typical positions. So the sun's off to the right, so you can imagine the solar wind's coming from the right-hand side this time. So in red is Cassini's trajectory, seen from looking down at the equatorial plane during the prime mission, so that was 1st of July 2004 to the 1st of July 2008. Then in blue, it's quite difficult to see, but that is the current mission, the Cassini Equinox mission. And then in orange, finally, is the trajectory during Cassini's proposed solstice mission. So this has not yet been officially approved, but this is one of the tours possible. So you can see that the coverage of the system around the planet, especially in terms of where we normally would expect them to, the outer boundaries to be, is really very good. I mean, we get to see a lot of the outer magnetosphere, which, as I've said, is where there's a direct interaction between the solar wind and the planet's field.
So, Adam, a quick question.
Sure.
The solstice mission is the dashed line? Kind of dashed? Which color is it?
Sorry, it's supposed to be orange. I'm not sure if it's
okay.
Badly.
Okay, yeah, I didn't reproduce that well in the PDF, but that's okay. I think it looks like it's kind of dashed.
Oh, apologies. Okay.
That's okay.
So, yes, as Marcia said, in the PDF version, the solstice mission trajectory should come out as a dashed line. But I think that the message of this, as you can see, is that regardless of which part of the mission or proposed mission we're looking at, we're getting a good coverage of the magnetospheric system. Okay, so finally, just before I carry on, just to avoid confusion, I wanted to say, because I remember when I started working on magnetospheric physics, I was always confused by regions of the magnetosphere and people using a lot of jargon. So I just wanted to define what the day side and night side of the planet were, which I think is quite straightforward, but also the dawn side and the dusk side. So in these two box schematics, the one to the left illustrates day side and night side, which as you're very aware is the sunward side, the anti-sunward side of the planet. And the schematic on the right illustrates the side of the system around the planet that we call the dawn side. So we're looking down on the planet's north pole in this schematic with the sun off to the left-hand side, and so you can see the ring plane. So the dawn side is the side shaded blue, and the dusk side is the side shaded red. So just in case, in the following slides, I mentioned dawn side boundary or dusk side magnetopause, for example. This is what I'm referring to. It's the side of the planet as if you viewed it from the top down, the two sides. Okay. So, if we go on to slide number 17, so during Cassini's approach to the planet, what did we learn about the solar wind and what sort of structure and what was its nature at Saturn's orbit? Okay, so this is a snapshot taken from a paper by Jack Minotaur in the year 2004. Okay, so this is a time series over a approximately 27-28 day period, so about a month. Of magnetic field data that was taken by the Cassini magnetometer instrument. So the top three panels show the components of the magnetic field, but I'm not going to focus on those, so for the moment if we just focus on the bottom panel, this is the strength of the magnetic field measured in nanoteslas, so how strong the field is. What you can see is that we have regions with very low field strength, of approximately 0.1 nanoteslas, and then we have a region of much stronger field strength for a certain period of time, which lasts approximately 14 days, I believe. And then there's another region of much more reduced field strength. Now, what Jack Minotaur just suggested was that in the solar wind, we actually have an alternating structure of compression regions and rarefaction regions. So that's what the blue shading and red shading is in this figure. So the red shaded region is when we were in a solar wind compression region, and the blue region is when we're in a solar wind rarefaction region. So because of frozen in flux, you can imagine that this field strength is a proxy for the density of the plasma. So essentially the picture we've painted is that in the solar wind near Saturn's orbit at the time that Cassini was approaching the planet in 2004, you had an alternating compression and rarefaction region structure. And that's illustrated by this simple schematic on the bottom left. So you can imagine the solar wind coming in, which is alternating regions of much denser plasma and then much more rarefied plasma. So as we're going to see, this is important for understanding how this sort of solar wind is going to affect the magnetosphere. Okay, at this stage, are there any further questions before I start to talk about the effects of the solar wind and why we're why it's important to understand how it affects your system.
So I think maybe this is a PDF issue, but I think in the bottom panel, what I'm looking at in the PDF, there's no magnetic field magnitude, but I presume that you had that originally, right, Adam?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I think maybe you could describe what you would see. Like in the rarefaction region, you probably see a low field strength.
Sure. I wasn't aware that in the PDF. In the bottom panel, essentially, what it is you have a region on the left-hand side. I mean, you can actually see it in the components quite well as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the components, you can see on the left-hand side, the magnitude of each of the components is quite low. And then at the first vertical dashed black line, you see an increase in most of the components and a lot more fluctuation. From that first dashed line to the final vertical black dashed line on the right-hand side of the stack plot, that's the compression region. That's the region where the field strength is higher. And you can pretty much see that from the fact that the components all get larger, even if they do fluctuate quite a lot. And then on the right-hand side, you can see that they settle down again to quite low values, and that's another rarefaction region. So what you're basically looking at is a compression region flanked by a rarefaction region.
Yeah. We'll make sure this gets fixed before we post it finally on the website.
Okay.
I think that this is probably a PDF issue. Thanks, Ed.
No problem. Okay, so if we now go to slide number 18. Okay, so how can this very regularly structured solar wind that Cassini observed affect the planet's magnetosphere? Well, the first way that it can, in some ways the most dramatic way in which it can affect the magnetosphere is the size of the cavity itself. So as we've already seen, the magnetopause position, so the magnetopause being the boundary of the magnetosphere, its position is really determined by a pressure balance between internal and external total pressure. So since you've got these regions of compressed and rarefied solar wind, that's going to change the amount of momentum hitting the magnetospheric cavity, and so it's going to make the magnetopause move. So if you go from a rarefied solar wind hitting the magnetosphere to suddenly much more compressed solar wind, that's going to make the magnetopause move towards the planet so that it can re-establish pressure balance. Okay, so to illustrate from actual observations and results, this is really a dramatic movement of the boundaries. I've taken a figure here from Arad et al., which was published in the year 2006. So in both of these panels, A and B, the horizontal axis with the sun off to the right-hand side is basically the direction along the line that connects the center of the planet to the sun. So it's the sunward direction. And it's measured in Saturn radii. And the vertical axis, which is shown as rho KSM, which is also measured in Saturn radii, is essentially the perpendicular distance of a magnetopause crossing from that planet-sun line. So then the squares plotted let's look at the top panel, panel A for starters. The black squares give the positions of a set of magnetopause crossings that Cassini made. So during tour of the planet, the spacecraft is going into and out of the magnetosphere. It crosses the magnetopause on a number of occasions, as we've already seen, because its orbit takes it far enough away from the planet. So this is where we have seen the boundary of the magnetosphere for a particular set of wet Arad et al. Analyzed. So you can see the black squares. And what's very clear from this is that if the planet is at the origin, as you can see at the bottom of panel A, where the dotted black line intersects the x-axis, you can see that there's a really large spread in the positions of the magnetopause boundary. In other words, pressure balance is in very different places depending on what the solar wind or the internal contributors to the pressure are doing. So what I've labelled in this top panel is a range of magnetopause positions derived by Arad et al., and you can see that the magnetosphere's size really changes over a huge extent. It almost doubles in size or halves in size. And this is primarily controlled by the dynamic pressure of the solar wind, where you have these big rarefaction regions and compression regions, and you get very dramatic changes in the external dynamic pressure. And that's why you get this really clear change in the size of the magnetosphere. Okay, so this in the bottom panel, panel B, this just shows the crossings that are normalized to the same pressure. They get the nominal shape and nominal position of the magnetopause. But the message I'm trying to get across from this slide is that solar wind can really change the size of the system around Saturn and that's going to cause the magnetic sphere to reconfigure. As we're going to see in the following slide, this compression and expansion of the magnetic sphere can really be important to understanding how the system responds to the solar wind. It's a very obvious way that the solar wind affects the system. So, that's the first very obvious effect that the solar wind could have on the planet's space environment and the system around the planet. On slide number 19, we're now going to talk a little bit about the effect the solar wind has on the planet's auroral emissions. So, like Earth, Saturn has aurora. So these couple of images, the one on the left is a photograph of the aurora borealis from the surface of the Earth, which is, I mean, I'm sure you're all very familiar with the northern lights and southern lights. These are very beautiful emissions, and on the right-hand side is a series of images taken by the Hubble Space Telescope of Saturn's southern polar region on January 24th, 26th, and 28th, as labelled. And it's a composition of visible and UV light superimposed on a visible light image of the planet. So you can see that around, approximately, and well, nominally an oval around Saturn's poles, you also get emission of light, a particular wavelength. And what you can see from these images is that they really vary a lot over a time period of days. Essentially, the source of these emissions at Saturn is similar to, essentially the same as the source of the emissions of the Earth. You can imagine charged particles that travel along the magnetic field lines of the planet and precipitate in the planet's upper atmosphere, and the reactions that then take place produce these really beautiful emissions. So the solar wind, as we're now going to see, can affect this feature of the magnetic sphere. Okay, so if you go to slide number 20, I think this is a really really nice result here, actually. This is taken from Crary et al., a paper that's published in the year 2005 in Nature magazine. So what happened here was during January of 2004, the Hubble Space Telescope was able to image Saturn's southern auroral region and see how the aurora changed with time. And at the same time as this was happening, Cassini was in the upstream solar wind on its approach to the planet and was able to measure the speed of the solar wind flow as well as things like the magnetic field strength. So I hope that this hasn't been cut off in the PDF, but in the bottom two panels, which are shaded part blue and part red, the upper part of the panel shows the speed of the solar wind denoted by U, measured in kilometers per second. So you can see that the solar wind speed starts at about 450 kilometers per second on the 25th and 26th of January. Then approximately halfway through the 26th of January, it increases quite dramatically, very sharply, up to approximately 550 kilometers per second, and it stays at that sort of high speed for the duration of the interval through to past the 30th of January. So in the magnetic field, which is the lower half of the panel, the field components are shown in different colors, but I think I hope you can make out that there's actually a black line, which is just the field strength, so it's the higher of the traces. So in the rarefaction region, the region shaded blue, which is characterized by the low solar wind speed, the magnetic field is also quite low. And then when you enter the compression region characterized by higher solar wind speeds, you get a much higher field strength. So these are our rarefaction and compression regions we were talking about. Now the vertical blue lines that cut through the time series, the link to images shown above, show Hubble Space Telescope images, and it indicates at what time the image was taken. So of the four images at the top, the one on the far left was taken when Cassini believed the rarefaction region hit the so the magnetic sphere was immersed in a region of rarefied solar wind. Then the second image along is just after the compression region is projected to have hit the magnetic sphere. So you can see a real change in the auroral emissions. And on one side, there's a lot more emission and it spills in towards the poles. In the next two images taken at later times, you can see that there's a lot of evolution of these emissions, and the aurora is clearly responding to the arrival of a compression region in the solar wind. It's causing the system to do something which makes the aurora really respond quite clearly. Okay, so if we now go on to slide number 21, We've just focused on emissions. Sorry, apologies. I should have said in slide number 20. These are emissions in the ultraviolet wavelength. This is the UV aurora. Going on to slide 21 again. That's not the only wavelength in which we see auroral emissions from Saturn. Another particularly important wavelength is radio. So we see emissions from Saturn's auroral zone, the radio wavelengths, which we call Saturn kilometric radiation, or FKR. So this diagram on the top right, which I've taken from Sassoni et al. 2009, illustrates Cassini detecting radio emissions from a region which lies on field lines that map to high latitudes on the planet. Okay, so this is a figure on the bottom left of this slide, which is taken from Bunce et al. 2005. Now, this is what I basically want to get across from here is how the FKR emissions also respond to the solar wind, in particular a solar wind compression region arriving. So you can see that on the x-axis, this is time for a six-day period. I believe this is the first orbit of the planet made by Cassini, or one of the initial orbits. So in the upper panel is the intensity of radio emissions. So on the y-axis is the frequency of the emissions, the x-axis is time, and the color, which is given on the scale by the color bar on the right-hand side, tells you the power of the emission at a certain frequency at a certain time. So for example, when you see a bright region of yellow, that tells you that those frequencies given by the y-coordinates at the time given by the x-coordinates, that's the power in that frequency. So you can see when there's increased emission or decreased emission. And in the bottom panel, this is the magnetic field strength. So closest approach to the planet was approximately on day 183, shown here. So you can see the field strength really increases as you get closer to the planet and goes off the scale, and then as we move away from the planet again, the field strength drops. What I want you to take from this is that based on the really regular structure of the solar wind that we saw on our approach to the planet, we can quite accurately predict when compression regions are going to hit the magnetosphere, because the structure is quite regular, as shown by Jackman et al. So during this orbit of the planet, if you look at the FKR emission, so this is the spectrogram at the top, there's a very clear burst of emission, which is labelled with a red line. So there's a clear periodicity in the emissions, which is a whole other topic for a whole other telecon. But the point is that periodicity is sort of a disruption. There's a very clear increase in the power of the emissions and an extension to lower frequencies. And this has been suggested to coincide with the arrival of a compression region. So not only does the UV aurora appear to respond strongly to the solar wind, but also the FKR radio emissions. And this mysterious modulation of the FKR emissions, which is approximately the rotation period of the planet, but this is one of the big questions of the Cassini era. The change in this modulation period of the emissions, so you know, the period with which we see these peaks in the FKR power, it is also potentially linked to solar wind speed, for example. Many recent studies have suggested that link, so I'm not going to say any more about that here, but that's another way in which the solar wind can affect this particular auroral emission. Okay, so at this stage, are there any further questions regarding these first two effects?
On slide 21 at the bottom panel, it says MP. Is that the magnetopause, and it crosses it several times?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Those are the magnetopause crossings. So as you pointed out, on the left-hand side, there's one magnetopause crossing indicated. On the right-hand side, there's numerous magnetopause crossings indicated. And that's a good point, actually. One thing I should say is that the magnetopause boundary moves very quickly. It moves at a speed that's typically much greater than the speed of the spacecraft. So when you see for a particular orbit, as you're traveling towards the planet from outside the magnetosphere to inside the magnetosphere, you're typically going to see numerous magnetopause crossings, because the boundary moves backwards and forwards at very high speed. So that's why there's more than one magnetopause crossing, and you're correct, MP is the labelling of that. Okay, so on slide number 22, This slide is a slight aside for the moment because I'm about to talk about the way that magnetic reconnection can affect the magnetic sphere. So this process is very complicated and is a subject of a lot of debate in the scientific community. And it can be potentially very important for our understanding of the dynamics of a planetary magnetic sphere. And it's a way in which the solar wind can affect the system, as well as the ways everybody looked at, which is just how a compression region can affect the system. Okay, so it's an important process, as I've said. The very simple picture of what magnetic reconnection is that if you have field lines that are oppositely directed in proximity to each other, so anti-parallel groups of field lines, they can break and reconnect with each other. Like I said, it's a very simple picture. So if you look at the two schematics from the right-hand side, in the upper schematic, you've got two sets of magnetic field. First is magnetic field 1, shown as red, and the one set of field lines below that are called magnetic field 2, shown in blue. So you can see that these field lines are anti-parallel, they're pointing in exactly the opposite direction. Now what happens in magnetic reconnection is that you get a reconnected field line. So in the bottom schematic, the purple field lines have reconnected, so you can see that there's a region which we call the X region, where essentially field lines, magnetic field line 1 and magnetic field line 2, certain field lines have broken and reconnected with each other. And then these block grey arrows give the plasma flow, so you have flow into the reconnection region, then flow away from the reconnection region. So all I want you to take from this slide is that reconnection is an important process where field lines break and join with each other, and it energizes the plasma. Okay, so if we now move on to slide number 23, now we can talk about how reconnection can affect the magnetosphere, in particular, in this case, dayside reconnection. In this series of schematics, I'm illustrating dayside reconnection. So on the left-hand side, there's a schematic where you've got a Saturn shown of its north pole and its sense of rotation and south pole. The red loop is a planetary magnetic field line. Then the vertical blue arrowed line is a IMS field line, so a field line in the solar wind. So between the red and the blue is the magnetopause, but I haven't shown it there for clarity. So imagine if at the magnetopause you have an interplanetary magnetic field which is strongly northward, so pointing up in the direction of Saturn's north pole. What that's going to produce at the magnetopause is anti-parallel field lines. So the planetary field and the IMS become anti-parallel, and you can see that in the schematic on the left-hand side. So if you have dayside reconnection, then in the middle schematic you can see what happens. You get the field lines that are tied to the planet's upper atmosphere suddenly reconnected with field lines that are in the solar wind, that are part of the solar magnetic field. And then in the third schematic on the right-hand side, you can see what happens to those reconnected field lines. So the solar wind flow pulls them over the top of the planet, over the polar region. So as you can see, a few slides before, we talked about how the magnetopause is, to the first approximation, a closed barrier between the solar wind and the planet's field. But as we've seen now, this is a process which, for example, we often see operating at the Earth magnetopause, whereby you can have connection between the solar wind and the planet's field. So this actually allows direct entry of solar wind plasma. You can think of this as sort of a first order view of the magnetopause. So when this happens, you can actually get solar wind entering the magnetosphere. So clearly this is important, as it can lead to, for example, at the Earth, this sort of process can generate auroral emissions. What Cassini's found at Saturn regarding dayside reconnection is there's been a paper which showed some observations of the operation of reconnection, the dayside magnetopause. So there's some evidence there, but however, the nature of dayside reconnection at Saturn does appear to be very different to that of Earth and Jupiter. The sort of features and phenomena that are related to reconnection that we'd expect in some cases aren't there, so it's clearly a process which can be important, but at the moment it's unclear to what the extent of its importance. Okay, so if we move on to slide number 24 now, this is the final slide on reconnection. So we've talked about reconnection on the day side of the planet, so what about reconnection in the planet's magnetotail? So there's another series of three schematics which illustrates tail reconnection. So on the left-hand side, you've got the sun off to the left. So we're looking at this time at a red arrowed planetary magnetic field line, which goes into the planet's magnetic tail. So this is the region behind the planet. So if you can imagine that the field line extends down the tail. So in the middle schematic, the field line is extended out. Now let's say that there's a region where the field parts of the field line come close together. And what you can see will happen in that situation is you do get anti-parallel field regions forming in the magnetic tail region. Now what happens in tail reconnection is that at this region of anti-parallel field, you can get reconnection taking place, and on the schematic on the right hand side you can see the reconnected field lines. So the planetary field line is reconnected with itself, leading a isolated plasmoid on the right of the schematic, which is ejected down the tail, and a planetary field line, a reconnected planetary field line, it then snaps back towards the planet. And there's some evidence, quite a lot of evidence for this process that's been uncovered by Cassini. And it's been suggested that the compression regions that we've seen in the solar wind that are going to make the magnetic sphere really contract, it's been suggested that they could trigger these episodes of tail reconnection. So this is a process that's going to energize the plasma. It's going to lead to lots of high energy particles that are going to go along the field line, hit the planet's atmosphere, and may generate a rural emission. So one proposal is that a compression region hits the magnetic sphere, you get lots of tail reconnection, precipitation of charged particles, lots of rural emissions. So this sort of fills in the gap between solar wind and what it does to the size of the cavity and how the aurora responds. So this is a sort of process that can achieve that. So as I've said, the rural emissions, and we also see lots of energetic neutrals coming from the vicinity of these tail reconnection sites. An open question is whether Earth-like substorms occur at Saturn. So that's to say that is it the dayside reconnection going on that then leads to a tail reconnection event? In other words, if you open up lots of flux on the day side through reconnection, does it eventually close in the tail? So is it driven by that, as opposed to simply if you get a compression region, a field lines in the tail reconnect? So the question is it the same sort of process that operates at the Earth, and is it what we call the Dungey cycle? And that remains an open question, I believe, in the Cassini era. Okay, so before I go on to the last of the effects I'm going to talk about, is there any further questions at this point? Okay, so moving on to slide number 25, this is the final one of the four effects. So there are other effects that the solar wind can have on the magnetosphere, but these are the four I was going to talk about in this particular telecon. So this final effect is one that I've done quite a lot of work on during my PhD, and this is waves on the magnetic poles and outer boundaries. Because the magnetic poles is a boundary that's determined by pressure balance, you can imagine it as a bubble around the planet. And just like if you were to perturb the surface of the bubble, waves move on the surface of the bubble away from where you perturb the surface. Same thing could happen on a planetary magnetic pole. So if you have lots of fluctuations in the solar wind pressure, you're going to create ripples on the bubble that move around it in the direction of the flow. So this schematic on the very bottom of this slide illustrates waves on the boundary. So another way that you can produce waves on the boundary, other than by perturbing it and leading to waves, is also something which we call the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, and this is what I've been particularly working on. So this is analogous to what happens when you get wind blowing over the surface of the sea on the Earth. Kelvin-Helmholtz instability is a instability that grows at the interface between two fluids, and the conditions are really appropriate for growth when there's a big flow shear across the boundary. So for example, if you have a flow on one side of the interface pointing one way and a flow on the other side of the interface pointing the opposite way, there's a big change in the flow across the boundary, and under those sort of conditions the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability can grow. So this schematic on the bottom illustrates what happens at an interface. So the magnetic pole is shown, and time goes from the top of the schematic to the bottom, so you start off with a nominally unperturbed boundary. And let's say that across either side of that boundary you've got two flows given by these blue arrows, V1 and V2. So there's a large flow shear across the boundary. What happens when the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability grows is that it manifests itself as waves in the boundary. So this is, you imagine you've got the surface of the sea, wind blows over the surface, and then you get waves. It's exactly that sort of analogous process. And just like waves can then break on the seashore, these surface waves on the manetopause can evolve into, as the instability enters its nonlinear phase, they can produce these vortex structures. This has been seen at the Earth's manetopause, so this is a way that you can transport solar wind plasma into the manetosphere as well, and it's a way of adding sort of a viscous interaction with the manetosphere. So this schematic on the top right shows Saturn's manetosphere very crudely. Once again, it's not to scale at all. You've seen lots of schematics like this. But in this case, the solar wind flow is incident on the left, given by these red arrows. The black line is the manetopause, and these blue arrows give the magnetospheric flow. So this is the flow of plasma within the magnetosphere that could be, for example, of origin being Enceladus, for example. So you've got magnetospheric plasma, and it approximately co-rotates with the planet. So that's to say it circulates the planet in the sense of planetary rotation. So that's, we're looking down on Saturn's north pole in this case, so these blue arrows show the sub-co-rotating flow. Now what you can see is, on the dawn flank of the manetopause, as opposed to the dusk flank, there's a much greater flow shear. The solar wind flow around the boundary is approximately opposite to the manetospheric flow, whereas on the dusk flank you can see that they're pointing in the same direction, even if they're not the same magnitude. What this means is that the dawn side of the manetosphere is much more susceptible to the growth of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability than the dusk side. So in the next slide I'm going to show some recent results regarding waves on the manetopause boundary. So if we move to slide number 26, this is the final slide before I summarise everything I've been talking about. So some of the work I've done is illustrated by this schematic on the bottom left, which is taken from a paper that's published this year. Saturn is labelled, and you can see the manetopause boundary. Once again, in this case, the solar wind is incident from the right-hand side. And what I've shown here is a magnified view of the boundary. So for a particular Cassini orbit, we were able to analyse the manetopause at this sort of position, shown by the circle that then expands into a bigger oval. And what we found was that there was evidence of waves in the manetopause, likely driven by the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And this is the dawn flank, remember, where we expect the instability to grow because of the large flow shear. And what we also found was that the waves in the boundary weren't simple, they were complicated. There appeared to be two types of wave mode. So you can see here that what we proposed was that there was a relatively large amplitude, longer wavelength waveform, and superimposed on that potentially was a shorter amplitude, shorter wavelength waveform. So it's a very complicated boundary, as you can see. Final thing to say about waves in the manetopause is that these waves are going to launch compressive waves, so more waves that go into the manetosphere. So you know, you're compressing the plasma just inside the boundary, and it's going to launch waves that go back towards the planet. So this is another way that solar wind energy is effectively transported into the manetosphere. And this schematic on the bottom right of this slide, taken from Kram et al. 1998. Who found evidence of resonant mode coupling in the magnetosphere. So effectively what we can think of this is it's a resonance between waves that are launched from the magnetopause because of surface waves in the boundary and planetary magnetic field lines. So in this schematic you can see a planet's field line, you can see surfaces in the magnetopause, and you can see what happens. You get waves set up on the field line as a result of resonance between the compressive waves that propagate in and the field line itself. And this is something that evidence was found for this with Voyager 1. But we really need to look at the Cassini data in more detail to find more evidence of this. And this is just one of the ways, one of the things we can still do with the Cassini data that really needs to be done. And it's important for understanding how the solar wind can put energy into the system. If I now move on to slide number 27 before moving on to questions, just to summarise what I've been talking about. So I focused on the physics of the interaction between the solar wind and Saturn's magnetosphere. I've given an introduction to why Saturn has a magnetosphere and its general structure in terms of the outer boundaries where there's a direct interaction. So we've seen that the space environment around the planet, the magnetosphere itself, is complex, and it can be profoundly affected by changes in the solar wind in terms of its scale, tail reconnection events that we've seen evidence for, potentially dayside reconnection, auroral emissions that we've seen respond very strongly, and also waves in the boundaries. So there's lots of ways in which the solar wind can put energy into the system around the planet. And in many ways, this interaction that Cassini is revealing at Saturn is different from the interaction at the other planets of the solar system, for example, Earth and Jupiter, which we can make some really interesting comparisons with. So just to finish off, it's clear that Cassini's ongoing exploration of near Saturn space is important for our understanding of planetary manetospheres, and hopefully in the future, based on Cassini observations, we can further improve our understanding of this complicated environment. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adam. That was really interesting. You did a really nice job of explaining some of these concepts that are really not very simple. So it was really clear and concise. So thank you very much. Are there questions for Adam about anything about the magnetosphere, magnetospheric physics? I've got one question. I know that this solar cycle has been particularly weak. And so I expect that we don't know anything about how that's affecting Saturn, because perhaps we haven't had the orbit geometry, or perhaps we haven't had the observations. But could you say anything about that, or even speculate about, with a weak solar wind, how that would affect Saturn's magnetosphere?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think given that we have a good understanding of the structure of the solar wind during Cassini's approach to Saturn, which was a declining phase of the solar cycle, as we've seen. As you're saying, at the moment we're not sure what's happening, to be quite honest, with the solar cycle, and it's a really something that a lot of people are working on to try and understand why we don't appear to be ascending to a solar maximum again now. To speculate, if we stayed at a solar minimum, where if we were to have very low solar wind speeds and relatively rarefied solar wind, then I'd expect that that's going to lead to a more expanded magnetosphere more of the time. But I think that given that we haven't got extensive observations of the solar wind upstream of the planet's magnetosphere during this really unusual time of solar activity, I'd be very cautious to make any firm statements about what we'd expect the magnetosphere to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Maybe we'll get some orbits that go out into solar wind, and we can figure some of this out before too long if the sun doesn't recover. I don't know if people have been aware of this, but this solar minimum has extended much longer than people expected. So it's very odd. Any other questions for Adam? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Adam. It was really interesting. And if people had any problems with the PDF while they were following along, we'll make sure that those figures that somehow got botched up during the conversion from PowerPoint to PDF, we'll make sure those get fixed when it gets posted again on the web, because the PowerPoint is perfect. So, again, thank you very, very much, Adam. Let me quickly mention what's going on next month. We have our anniversary telethon, which we do every year. We're going to do it in two parts this time, so it'll be in June and July. And I won't be here, but Mary Beth Merle from the Cassini Project will host that telethon. And the first one, let's see, we're going to do it a bit out of order because of people's availability. So the first telethon on June 30th, we're going to have Andy Ingersoll. He's a Saturn scientist. He's particularly interested in Saturn's atmosphere, so he'll talk about Saturn. And Claudia Alexander will talk about the magnetosphere. And again, this is to highlight mostly the new discoveries of the past year. And the following month in July, Linda Stilker, the deputy project scientist, is going to be giving an overview of the mission and what's coming up. And then Zibby Turtle will cover icy satellites and Titan, and Jeff Tuzzi will cover the ring. So those should be both very interesting telecons. So with that, unless anybody has anything to add, I think we're done. And thank you again very much. Talk to you in a couple of months. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.